Yeah, kids, Finn with you. Finn's Revolution till the 9 p.m. hour right here on WUSB. Stony Brook, tonight we have a very special night. We have Mr. Mark Bingham, amazing record producer, talks about some of his new stuff and some of his great past stuff, and great music journalist and founder of Trouser Press, Ira Robbins, talks about his new novel. Stay tuned. Yeah, founder of the Trouser Press, legendary publication, music publication. Ira Robbins is going to be with us in just a second. We're going to get him on the line. His new book is called Mark Bolan, Killed in Crash, set in wild late 70s UK. And we're going to listen to a little something from that period, or maybe a little bit earlier than that, but relative to the title. And we're going to be talking with Ira Robbins in just a minute. Jeepster right there by T-Rex, Mr. Mark Bolan on guitar and vocals. And a new novel out, not so much about Mark Bolan, but does take its name from Mr. Bolan. It's called Mark Bolan, Killed in Crash. And we are lucky enough right now to have its author, Trouser Press founder, Mr. Ira Robbins with us. Ira, can you hear us?
I sure can.
Great to have you on the air on Finn's Revolution, my friend.
Thank you.
An honor and a privilege. And the book, let's get right into the book factor, and then we'll deal with a little history, I think. We'll see where we go. But you've been writing fiction for a little bit now. You want to talk about your experience getting into fiction from rock journalism, from music journalism?
I reviewed records for a really long time, and including a stint at Newsday, where I reviewed concerts and records. Mm-hmm. And there was just a lot of life, and it sort of reached a point where I kind of started feeling like maybe I didn't have anything left to say about it, or at least nothing new, helpful, original that I hadn't already said before. So I just started kind of jotting things down, and at some point it kind of coalesced into an idea about a novel about the 60s radicals. And I was a 60s radical, but I didn't have the kinds of experiences that I wanted to write about. So I just sort of created a character and put her in the middle of a bunch of problems. And that book is called Kick 'Em Till It Breaks. Mm-hmm. And it came out about 10 years ago, 11 years ago. And so that was my first experience. I kind of didn't know what I was doing. I really kind of botched it. I sort of did the approach very poorly. So like I was kind of writing as I went without really knowing where I was going. You know, a lot of writers do very careful outlines of what they're going to do before they write. I didn't. And so I was kind of making it up as I went along. And then I showed it to my agent, and she looked at it and said, you've got like four stories here. You should really cut it down to like one or two. So I took about half of it out and wrote it back up and then self-published it. And then I started thinking about the response I'd gotten, which was like, why, as a music writer, did you write a book about politics in the 60s? And I thought, well, maybe I should take people's advice and write a book about music. So I thought, well, what musical era and time and place really feels important to me? And so, you know, I mean, there's obvious ones that I've been involved with, like the punk era and, you know, British Invasion and, you know, indie rock and things like that. But I sort of had this idea that glam rock in London in 1970, early 70s, was really underrepresented in literature and journalism. You know, it had never really been taken that seriously because it was kind of a small scene with, like, you know, 15 or 20 bands, and very few of them had much of an impact in America. So I just sat down to write a novel about that time and place, the idea being that it was something that I hadn't done, would have liked to have been there for. I mean, I was there briefly, but was never part of it, and so I just thought I would kind of put myself there by writing fiction about it.
Yeah, and you really, really do. Did you come up with the general storyline in your head first, or did it kind of come as you went?
It evolved. I mean, I had a character, and I had a character who was a young girl, just an ordinary school girl. She's 14 years old in London. It's 1972, and I wanted her to somehow become famous, and I wasn't sure how to do that. And I kind of built the pieces as I went along. And so she gets involved with a kind of a fading rock star who's a little over the hill and doesn't really know how to deal with the change in music. You know, he's sort of a 60s guy, kind of like a cock rock dude. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the music in England is becoming like, you know, dress up with like, you know, lipstick and makeup and, you know, high heels and women's dresses and, you know, very different kind of sound from the bluesy, we're going to jam until our hair grows out kind of sound. And that he has a manager who has this idea about how to get him back in the game, and she becomes his secret weapon as kind of like a market research project.
Mm-hmm. And the character development, we're not going to give away too much, but between Frank, the manager's character, is everything he should be.
You know? He's tough, and he's cagey, and he's shrewd, and he's kind of a plotter.
Right.
You know, and he gets things done. You know, I mean, he understands that your client, his client, is not necessarily going to see what's right for him to do, and so he needs to kind of like trick him into doing the right thing.
Right. And both the young ladies who are involved in it are also quite they're different, but not all that different ultimately.
I guess I have somewhat of a negative view of the goodness of humanity, and so if people are given an opportunity to take advantage of each other, you know, it's been my experience that, you know, that does happen from time to time. And so, you know, the two main characters, the young girl whose name is Lila, and this woman that she becomes involved with on various levels, whose name is Amanda, you know, they kind of dance around each other for the whole book, and they change places a little bit, and you know, growing up is an important phenomenon in life, and you know, from 14, you know, you're barely formed, and then you know, 5, 6, 7 years later, you could be somebody completely different, and so you know. They dance around each other, you know, and they get a little involved, and you know, it's that time and that place.
And you've really been very, very, you really evoke the era and the place. And I was particularly, once again, not giving away too much, but you give away the atmosphere of the, for example, the underground. You really capture it, and it's detail is beautiful in it. You did a nice job.
I've been in London a lot of times, and you know, I mean, I've started going to, I guess my first time in England was in 1971 or so, and I've been back, I don't know, 20 or 30 times, and so, you know, and I'm very, very fond of London and have a pretty good sense of it, but I mean, as I was writing this, I made a couple of trips, and you know, I literally walked my way through places that I wanted to write about and took notes. You know, the title of the book is just Boland died in a car crash, of course, and I happen to have a poster on my wall from which is the cover of the book, which I got in England, and it's just a newspaper poster that announced his death, and I just sort of felt that sort of resonated with the time. You know, it would give people an immediate sense of the time and the place. You know, I mean, most of the action of the book takes place long before he dies, but he died in 1977, and so you know, the era is, you know, is 5 years there, and by that time glam rock was well over. You know, he was kind of mounting a bit of a comeback, but it wasn't really that big a deal. You know, and so you know, I wanted to kind of give it historical accuracy as much as I could, which became very complicated for a while. I mean, I ended up like having to do some real major surgery about halfway through because I had characters that were just completely, that were tied to historical events, and they couldn't be the age that I needed them to be if they were tied to those historical events. So at some point I had to shift the whole thing by a few years in order to make it work. But like, for instance, like the there's a concert at the Marquee with Roxy Music and UFO that Lila goes to, and it's a real show. I mean, I wasn't there, but I mean, it's documented. I mean, they did actually play on that bill on that date, and so, you know, in that venue. So, you know, I tried to make those things accurate, and I mean, it's a little bit of you know, the sense of what England was like in the early 70s with strikes and things like that. You know, and then, you know, I didn't bring in a lot of real characters. I mean, there's one scene that you'll remember, which they kind of run across members of The Who. You know, but otherwise, you know, the characters that are real are mentioned in passing. You know, I mean, you know, they're like people you meet on the, you know, backstage at shows and things like that.
Right, and you really get a sense of I don't know. You get. It was like a whole different time. You know, it was like almost a sudden change. I mean, from the hippiness, although that included a lot of dressing up and prancing about as well. But it was, and all of a sudden, bang! Like things changed culturally a lot.
Yeah, I mean, what happened, I think, was that you know, the idea that rock had to be kind of streetwise and, you know, down to earth and unpretentious. I mean, that was really what happened in England in the late 60s. You know, there were a lot of, you know, sort of these jammy kind of bands that played a lot of free festivals. I mean, there was a whole era of you know, the Hawkwinds and the Edgar Broughton Band and Man and Help Yourself and, you know, Hawk and Pink Fairies. You know, I mean, and they were all, like, very progressive and, you know, down to earth, and they didn't mess around, you know, and they were kind of like the MC5 in America in a sense, you know. And then these bands came along that were, you know, very theatrical, you know, very costumed, you know, very arch, to use a word, you know, and their whole, you know, style was really a refutation of the, you know, put on a t-shirt and jeans and go up and jam kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously Bowie was, you know, was the leader of this pack, but, you know, people in America don't realize how enormously successful Mark Boland was in England. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, for America, you know, Get It On is the one song, right? I mean, you know, that's it, you know, bang a gong. You know, and yet, you know, he had something like 12 number, like top 5 singles in the course of like 18 months or something. You know, I'm not remembering the chart specifically, but I mean, you know, he's just loaded with singles. I mean, my CD drawer of T-Rex reissues is like, I don't know, got maybe 40. You know, I mean, like, there's so much stuff of his. And he was, you know, he was like the god of gods in those days. I mean, you know, he's a small, you know, funny, you know, quirky Jewish guy, you know, who didn't really play guitar that well, but he was a star in every possible meaning of the word. And I, one of the things I was trying to capture in the book was sort of the way in which fandom really took people's, you know, took over people's lives. You know, just sort of, you know, I think anybody who's, you know, 15 years old or, you know, or lived through the Spice Girls or whatever, you know, understands that. But I think it's important to kind of take it back to that era, you know, and put these names in front of people who they wouldn't necessarily think were ever that big a deal, you know. I mean, Bowie, you know, you might, you know, there's people who think of Bowie as like China Girl, right, or, you know, Let's Dance, you know. But, I mean, Bowie was, you know, was this godlike figure, you know, in a dress, you know, standing on the stage of the Rainbow, you know, just completely, you know, bowling people over, you know, and every word he said was you know, important to people, and bowling, you know, the same thing. So, you know, I was just trying to sort of, I guess, compare what was going on in England, which was pretty dire. I mean, you know, in England in those days, like, a secretary made like £30 a week, which was like maybe $65. Mm-hmm. That was like a standard salary. So, I mean, you talk about people whose entire annual salary in like early 70s was like $3,000 or $4,000. Now, you know, I mean, we were around in the 70s, and, you know, we were doing better than that, you know, but life was just much more low-key in England. It was cheap, and it was, you know, it was kind of unsuccessful, and there just wasn't much ambition. And then these glam rock stars came along, and all of a sudden, you couldn't be too beautiful or too rich or too glamorous or too stylish or too trendy, you know, and it really turned England on its head, much in the same way that the 60s did.
Yeah, and of course, those secretaries at the time, especially people like Amanda, were spending that $65 a week on wardrobe. So,
of course, yeah, down the King's Road. No, I mean, I made her a fashion plate. I mean,
which was perfect.
Yeah, I mean, you know, she's like, you know, your dream girl, and if you want to ask the question, go ahead. But I really don't have anybody in mind for any of the characters. There's the Frank. I had an actual rock manager in mind, but only visually. You know, not that he ever did any of those things that Frank does, or you know. So, but people just assume that when you write a book like this, that, you know, that everybody's based on somebody, and in my case, they're not. I'm pretty strongly opposed to thinly veiled fiction. So, you know, I really wanted to write a book that just, you know, I made up. You know, and you know, there are a couple of things in there in the book that I did actually experience at one time or another in my life, but they're really small things, and they're not significant. I mean, you know, I never did any of the things that any of the main characters do.
Okay. Did you have anyone proofing this as you went to say, does this sound real to you?
I have a friend in England who wrote a book called Filthy English, which is about cursing.
Okay.
A journalist friend. And he read over maybe 4 or 5 chapters for the British slang to kind of vet the slang. And I mean, I have a shelf full of British slang dictionaries, so I have a lot of reference material. But he kind of, he added kind of the personal touch by saying things like, oh, that's something a girl would never say. That's strictly something a guy would say. You know, and you and I would be able to do that for, like, you know, New York slang. You'd go like, you know, a woman wouldn't say that, or, you know, or that wasn't something we said in the city. That was something that, like, people in the Midwest said, you know. And you know, so I tried to be, I mean, what we haven't said is that, you know, the book is written in very strongly slangy British argot, you know. Uh-huh. And there's a Scottish character who's almost completely impenetrable in his accent, which I tried to render as carefully as possible, you know, the way Scottish people, well, some Scottish people speak. I mean, you know, I've been watching a lot of British and Scottish and Irish television the last couple of years, and it sort of seeped into my consciousness, you know.
Well, the other cool thing about it is that not only are you doing Anglo slang and stuff like that, but you're also it's dated Anglo slang, you know.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You really gotta, yeah. So that's what's tough too, I think, trying to nail all that. And we are talking right now with Ira Robbins, author and journalist and founder of Trouser Press, former writer for Newsday, whole bunch of things in the world, and we're talking about his new book, Mark Bolan killed in crash, and quite the fantastic read, and apparently also an expert on UK slang. So there you go. It's another side job he's got. At least the writing thing doesn't pan out.
I try not to be pretend that I'm an expert. I'm versant in it. I would say, you know, better. It's better, more useful to me than my French.
Very good, very good.
And if I can get a plug in, the book is available from Amazon.
That's right, it certainly is. We're going to get to that too. Now, okay. Now you said you were originally in London around 71, around the time that this book is set.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, what brought you there first, Ira?
My first visit to England was part of an American Youth Hostel's bike trip. I went with a bunch of kids from Long Island. AYH is an organization that organizes travel and has these kind of like youth hostels all over the world that they kind of can book you into. And so we went on a bike trip from London to the British coast. We took the ferry to France, bicycled to Paris, took the train to Switzerland, biked from one end of Switzerland to the other, and then took the train to Amsterdam and flew home. And it was a month-long trip, and I guess we spent about three or four days in London. But I went back the next year with a good friend of mine alone, and we did it again. And then by the time we had started Trouser Press in 74, I spent a month in London by myself in June of 74, and really kind of soaked it up. Went around showing the magazine to people and getting free records. And I stayed in the hotel that the Beatles stayed in the first time they ever went to London.
Okay.
I found that out recently by reading Mark Lewisohn's Beatles book.
Oh, so in other words, you didn't seek that out. That was something you fell into. Oh, that's a cool little bit of history there.
Yeah.
So when you were growing up, you probably, like every person on the planet, were a Beatles fan, yeah?
I was turned on to the Beatles when I was 10, yes.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
You know, it had a huge impact on my life. But I didn't stay completely obsessed with the Beatles. I mean, past like, I don't know, 67. I never liked Sgt. Pepper's.
Mm-hmm.
And so by that time, I'd become a Who fanatic. So, you know, I was sort of, you know, like if the Beatles were more of a pop band, you know, I became much more of a hard rock guy.
Right.
You know, Stones and Who and, you know, things like that. Not Led Zeppelin.
You drew the line.
I drew the line.
Very good. So you were in love with some British music of some kind or another by the time you arrived there in 71.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, for sure.
And had expanded out to be interested in other things. Did you pick up records the first time you were there? Did you buy any records to bring back?
No, because we were bicycling. I mean, I literally had no way of carrying anything. But when I went in 74, this is funny. I went in 74. I stayed in this hotel off of Russell Square, and I had a room that was probably the size of my bathroom now. You know, I mean, it's basically a bed and a sink, and I don't think it didn't have a toilet. The toilet was down the hall. And so I was there for a month, and I had copies, the early copies of Trouser Press, which were mimeographed. We'd only done two at that point.
With a bit of an extended title, I believe, the original title.
Transoceanic Trouser Press, yes. I guess we've done three. And so I was there showing it off to people and sort of introducing what we were doing. You know, just completely absurdly presumptuous that people would in London would care that there was this, you know, mimeographed stapled fanzine in New York writing about some of the bands that they were working with. But I went around to every label in London and a bunch of fanzines and got... And they all gave me records. I mean, it was kind of like those were very different days than now. And you know, they were just, you know, excited to see somebody who knew about the stuff they were putting out. And they figured, you know, great, we'll get a toehold in America. And so I ended up piling up about, I don't know, 150 albums in my room. And then I kind of got to, like, you know, a couple of days before I was going to go home, and I'm like, holy cow, how am I going to get these things home? I mean, you know, it wasn't like I had, you know, like I had rolly cart suitcases that I could just fill up or anything like that. I mean, I had, like, you know, my duffel bag or whatever that I had my, you know, underpants in. You know, I got some T-shirts, you know, and so, you know, and I bought some stuff. I mean, it's, you know, and so... I made a triage decision. I literally went through them, picked out like the 50 that looked the most interesting, because I didn't have a record player, so I hadn't heard any of them. All I could do was go by the covers. So I picked out like the 50 best looking ones, and I sold the rest. Really? I went to like the used shops up on Portobello Road and on Goulburn Road and sold them because like I literally had nothing else to do. I mean, I had no other way to get them home. And then when I realized that I was going to get dinged for customs, mm-hmm. I mailed a bunch of them back to myself. So it turned out you could mail like 4 pounds worth of records or something like that, or 2 pounds worth of records, which is like 4 records. So I got like these big mailers, and I mailed like 20 packages of like 4 records each or 2 records each or something. And they arrived in my house when I got back, like over the course of like 8 months. I mean, like they would just like drift in. They were it was being sent by surface, like sea mail. They were literally on like boats somewhere. But I brought home, you know, I brought home maybe 30 or 40 in my hand, and the rest came slowly in the mail. But I did unfortunately have to sell promos unopened, unheard, and just kind of like, you know, which I would have liked to have had. I mean, they were British records, you know, with those nice, you know, glossy covers and everything, and, you know, nice pressings and all. But, you know, but there's just no way. So, yeah.
Did you happen to take note of anything that caught your interest that you had to get rid of? And
no, back no. Later?
You didn't even want to look at them. Off they went.
I wasn't that organized. I was 20 years old. I was like, you know, out of my mind, excited to be there. You know, I was exhausted. You know, it was weird being alone, you know, in a foreign city by yourself for a month. I mean, yeah. It was like, you know, I'd go like a day or two without talking to anybody, you know, try to imagine like a time when, you know, you're in a hotel room without a phone. You know, the only way to contact anybody is to go to a payphone. British payphones, I don't know if you know, at the time were really horrible. You know, I mean, like you put money in, and they would go beep 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 beep, and then you had to put more money in, and then like, you know, if they didn't answer, you had to get your money back. It was just like really complicated, you know. And then, you know, you'd call somebody and say, you know, here's who I am. I'd like to come by and meet with you. And they'd go like, well, he's not in. He'll be back in an hour. You know, what number can he call you at? He's like, you can't. I have to call you again. You know, so it was just, it was complicated. I mean, cell phones have made these sorts of, it would have been easier if I had a cell phone. Let's put it that way.
All right. So let's, now that we talked about your little first taste of London, let's discuss a little about something I know a lot of people are fascinated by, and I know you're probably discussed it a gazillion times, but trouser press.
Mm-hmm.
What was your impetus for doing all that? Did you do it as a fan? Was that the angle here?
Well, trouser press started, my best friend in high school and I were doing like this weird genealogy project. We were both sort of devoted to British rock at that point, and we used to go to the Lincoln Center Library and look at microfilm of the British. Well, they had Melody Maker on microfilm, and we were trying to build a complete database in 1973 of every British musician we could find and what groups they were in and when and in what sequence. And I still have the pieces of paper that we scribbled this stuff on. And then somewhere towards late 73, we met this woman at a sort of at a record hop in Yonkers, and just got talking. I mean, Dave Schultz and I had been trying to write. We were both writing for our college papers, and I'd sent stuff to Cream, and I was starting to write for Good Times, and, you know, just a little bit of, like, you know, freelance writing. And we met this woman who had been the editor of the Brooklyn College newspaper. Her name was Karen Rose, and we thought, we just sort of got this idea of starting a magazine. And so it was just basically because we felt that the stuff that we liked, we couldn't read about anywhere. You know, and again, not to really come off like the old guy, but, you know, 1973, you know, the resources for learning about the bands you liked were non-existent. You know, I mean, you could go to a record store and look at the records. You couldn't read a book. There were no books. There were certainly no magazines devoted to history like that. You know, there were no videos. There were no online resources. I mean, there was just nothing. You know, so we were kind of like, we felt like our interests were underserved, and those interests were The Who, the Yardbirds, Peter Frampton, Rory Gallagher. Mm. You know, just like kind of a handful of British, Irish, and Scottish musicians who we really, really liked, whose records we collected, and who, you know, the Kinks, Pretty Things, you know, mostly sort of British Invasion stuff, but up through the 70s. And so we thought we would start a magazine to kind of write about the stuff we liked. So, yeah, to answer your question simply, yes, we were fans.
Okay. And so you got it off the ground, and you began to do this. And how were you circulating it? How was it getting out there?
The first issue we mimeographed and stapled by hand and sold in front of the Academy of Music on 14th Street in Manhattan.
Perfect location.
We had a marketing scheme. We were smart as hell. We wrote articles about bands that we knew that we liked that were coming to town to play. So I mean, we literally had this scoped out. So the first show we sold the magazine at was a Rory Gallagher concert at the Academy of Music. And there was an article in that first issue about Rory Gallagher.
Perfect.
Who's an Irish guitar player that died a number of years ago, but really, really great player, sort of jazz, blues. And so we sold it there, and then a couple of nights later there was a show at the Garden that Deep Purple was headlining, and I forget who the connection was. And, you know, the second issue, there was a Mötley Crüe concert that we put on the cover. I mean, we weren't writing about the concerts. We were writing about the bands that we knew were going to be playing concerts.
So therefore, you had an audience there to pick them up.
Theoretically, yeah. So, I mean, we spent a lot of time outside and inside the Academy of Music. I mean, we never got thrown out or anything like that. I mean, we would bring magazines with us and sell them, you know, in the back of the hall, like in between bands and stuff.
Oh, inside, though, right? You did it.
Yeah,
inside.
I mean, the first one we were outside, but the second one we went inside. So that was the original idea, and then it just sort of evolved from there. I mean, we eventually began getting distribution through Gem Records, which was an importer that we worked with, we knew in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And we would pack up shipments and send them to record stores. I mean, there were stores in the village that we had dealings with, the Discophile and Discount Records and Golden Disc, and they would just carry it, you know, because like it appealed to their audiences, because we were doing sort of collector's stuff and we were doing discographies and sort of nerdy, you know, like here's everything you need to know about you know, Gentle Giant or something like that. We were doing some prog rock also. And it just kind of grew. And then, you know, we started in 70, we published the first issue in 74, and by like, you know, 77, 76, 77, you know, we started hearing from our friends in England what was going on there, and we were reading the British weeklies and seeing, you know, these show, you know, reviews of like these Clash shows and, you know, and Sex Pistols and stuff, and we got really excited about that, started getting all the records, and we just, kind of the magazine became very new wave oriented, because that was much more thrilling to us than, you know, the rest of the stuff that was going on in music.
Yeah, and that's probably when I was first picking up Trouser Press, around 76 or so,
mm-hmm.
maybe 70, yeah. And I was making trips, because I lived on Long Island at the time. I was making trips into the city to grab copies of that, among other things.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like I couldn't put it down. You know, it became like very much like Cream was for me, too.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, the thing that we heard from people then and much more recently is that, you know, people growing up in, like, you know, isolated small towns, we were like their connection to the stuff that they cared about, you know. I mean, we were their friend, you know. We were like, it was like having a big brother who brought records home with him, you know. And it was like, you know, we ran ads for indie bands, and we interviewed people, and, you know, I mean, what we were doing wasn't different from what anybody else was doing. We just had our own perspective, you know, and we were very opinionated and very strict about what we thought we wanted to write about and what we didn't want to write about. We didn't get pushed around, you know. We didn't make deals with record companies, and we just kind of, you know, we just did it our own way. I mean, we basically were too stupid to know better, you know. So we just made it up as we went along. But I mean, you know, eventually, you know, we had national distribution. You know, we had four color printing. You know, we were, you know, pretty substantial magazine. We had a circulation around 60,000 when we were, like, you know, really cruising along. And we had a staff of six people. And, you know, it was a real business. And it went for 10 years. So, you know, I'm very proud of it. And you know, the funny thing is, you know, when we were doing it, you know, you're in an office, you know, two or three or four people at a time, you know, and you're working really hard. And, you're, you know, you get it to the printer and it goes in the mail. And then you go, like, I don't know what happened. You know, like, does anybody care? You know, we get, you know, some letters to the editor and stuff, and then we get, you know, subscription orders and stuff. But, you know, I mean, it was a tough haul, you know. You'd get, like, you'd open up the mail one day and there'd be, like, $30 in it, you know, and you've got, like, a payroll coming up on Friday. You know, you need $3,000, you know, and it's like, well, where's the money? And years later, you know, I've heard from so many people that have been complimentary and, you know, grateful for what Trouser Press did. You know, I don't know if they were all doing it at the time or if they all sort of, you know, I mean, because we did record guide books afterwards, a lot of people sort of conflate the record guides with the magazine.
Right.
It's like, oh, I'm a big fan of Trouser Press. I have all the books. You know, it's like, well,
right.
Did you ever read the magazine? It's like, no. What magazine, you know?
Right.
Which is fine. We have a long tail, I guess, but I'm always gratified by hearing, you know, the impact we had on people, and that, you know, that we gave people ideas of music they might like, and, you know, we turned them on to stuff, you know, because that was pretty much the only reason we did it, you know, was to, because we were excited about stuff, and, you know, we had this sort of proselytizing view of, like, hey, if it's cool, we should tell people about it. You know, that's why you write about music, right? I mean, you don't write about music, you know, to put it down. You write about music because you're excited about stuff.
Yeah, and that always came across in the magazine and the writers. And you had such a diverse group of writers coming in and out all the time, too.
Yeah, I guess so, yeah. I mean, you know, it's funny, I've looked back at a lot of this stuff, and, you know, it's not all that good, especially my own stuff. I mean, I'm sort of working on a bit of an anthology that I might publish online. And, you know, you look back to stuff you wrote when you're 24 years old, and, you know, you thought you knew everything, and it's like this cocky, you know, blah, 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 you know, these guys really stink, and, you know, here's why they stink, because they sound just like that other band that stinks. And it's like, and I'm like, God, what the hell was I thinking? You know, like where was my humility? You know, where was my journalistic, you know, dignity in this? But, yeah, we did have a pretty colorful collection of writers, and I'm very proud of the fact that we had a lot of women writers, you know, from the very beginning.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was just never an issue for us. I mean, you know, anybody that we thought was good was in, and we never, you know, we were kind of apart from the whole boys club of rock journalism. I mean, we weren't really part of that scene as much as, you know, other people I knew were.
Right, and that's a good point. I didn't even think of that, but that's a very good point, because you did have a lot of women authors coming in and out, women writers,
mm-hmm.
and that's true. That was pretty cool. And you weren't even trying to have it be cool. You were just doing
whoever
you liked. Yeah,
yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, I mean, we couldn't. You know, we needed writers, and people would come to us all the time with ideas, and, you know, or with you know, suggestions, and we were like, okay, you know, let's see some clips, and if the clips were good, you know, I mean, I guess I wonder in retrospect how much exclusion there was of women writers, and how much there was just kind of the sense that they would be excluded that kept people from trying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, we certainly didn't make any special effort to recruit, you know, diverse writers or anything like that. I mean, you know, we just kind of did what we ran into. You know, it wasn't that it wasn't a conscious thought of any sort. I mean, we didn't have a lot of black writers, but then we also didn't write about a lot of black music because, you know, our focus was pretty explicitly and devotedly to, like, white rock and roll. You know, although, I mean, we certainly wrote about some black artists.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we did a fair amount of reggae stuff.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of that, you do some great Jamaican patois in your book. You do translate that very nicely. Very convincing.
Well, you know,
it's hard to write like that. You know, I mean, I'm sure you know, but I mean, it's to capture in print the sound, and you did do a great job.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So now Trouser Press cooking along, and what was the downturn point? What about what year was this?
Oh, well, 82 or 83, we ran into a bunch of roadblocks, one of which was MTV, which began sort of usurping what we thought was our turf because a lot of the bands that became popular on MTV were the British sort of post-punk new wave bands that were colorful and had, you know, because Britain had a much deeper tradition of video production. And so when MTV came calling, you know, they found all these British bands with videos ready to go, whereas American bands had to kind of, like, start from scratch and kind of like, oh, we got to make videos, how do we do that?
Mm-hmm.
And so, that, you know, there was all the Duran Duran and Culture Club and Adam Ant.
And of course, the very first song, The Buggles, right?
Yeah.
So there you go.
Right. And so you know, as great as what, as much as what MTV was doing was valuable and helpful, it made us feel like writing about stuff wasn't nearly as cool as playing it on TV. You know, because at the time, you know, American radio, other than WLIR, was pretty much immune to the existence of these bands. And so, you know, we felt like, you know, we were the only way that American, not the only way, but you know, journalism was the way that Americans could find out about these British bands that were cool. And then MTV came along and basically said, well, you know, here's that band, here's their song, you know, here's their video. You know, and so we kind of felt like we'd been kind of competed with in a way that we couldn't compete back. Mm-hmm. And we had some money problems, and then we all sort of like, we kind of like lost enthusiasm for the stuff that our audience liked. You know, we sort of diverged from our audience. We had this weird problem where, like, Adam Ant became, like, the most successful cover we ever did. It was a great cover. But, like we didn't really want to just keep writing articles about Adam Ant, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, we were sort of in a bind of like, we weren't a fan magazine. You know, we weren't going to be, like, you know, sort of People magazine putting whoever's famous on the cover. We wanted to write about the bands that mattered to us, but we were in a problem of having to keep ourselves from going out of business at the same time. And so, right, you know, the mercantile aspect reared its ugly head, and it was sort of like, well, we could put, you know, Stackridge on the cover, or, you know, or Genesis or something like that, and no one will buy the magazine, or we could put Adam Ant or Duran Duran or, you know, Stray Cats or, you know, Madness or something, and we'll actually do pretty well. I mean, we started to feel like we were being pushed around unintentionally by the bands that were succeeding on MTV.
Right.
You know, like the bands that were popular on MTV were the ones that made the best videos, not necessarily the ones that made the best records.
Right.
And so, you know, we just, you know, it was like, I mean, we weren't going to put, like, Tony Basil on the cover because Mickey was a hit. Although it turns out that Tony Basil is a really fascinating character. I would have liked to have interviewed her. But, you know, but you know, it just sort of was a problem. And so a bunch of things kind of colluded at the same time, and it just sort of felt like we couldn't keep doing this the same way we'd done it. And I just sort of went from, like, feeling like I had to carry this thing forward to feeling like maybe there was a way of not carrying this thing forward. And so I put together a fairly extensive plan. It took a long while. We had a 10th anniversary blowout party at Irving Plaza. The Del Lords played and a couple of other bands, and it was really fun. Spent a lot of money, and then the next morning we went out of business.
Wow. Wow. But Trouser Press continued to live on through the books, the compilations of the record reviews and things like that, right? The articles.
Yeah, the first one was kind of like a compilation, and then after that, it was like all new material because
right,
there was no magazine at that point. It was all new material, and then we did five editions. The fifth one being the '90s book, which was entirely new because the previous we'd been kind of like building on the previous ones, and it just got to mm-hmm. be too much. So it would have been like 1,200 pages. So we simply took out all the old stuff and started from scratch, and did a book sort of like into the mid-90s, and then it just felt like it was just too much to continue, and so we pretty much switched over to it being a website, which there had been three of them. The first one kind of was torched sort of unintentionally. The second one just kind of ran out of gas because it wasn't being maintained, and the third one, which just launched a couple of months ago, is brand spanking new and is going great. So,
and what's cool about the new site is the fact that you can see all the old issues, you can see all the old articles, you can see all of that, and it's really accessible and nice and easy to navigate, and you guys did a good job with that because it's a
Thank
cool
you.
Thing. Yeah,
and it's got like 3,000. Artists reviewed of their albums. Unfortunately, they're not up to date. I mean, so, you know, the bands that did their thing in 1977 and then stopped, that's great. But the ones who've had, like, ongoing careers that have put out 30 records since 1995, they're sorely out of date. I apologize for that.
But it's a beautiful snapshot of a time and place, and
yeah,
it's very valuable journalism in there. It's really cool stuff. You know, one of my favorite writers of yours is a mutual friend of ours, who is Wayne King.
Mm-hmm.
And I always liked his style in the magazine too.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so good guy. This new book, Mark Bolan Killed in Crash, by Ira Robbins. How's the book doing? How's the reviews coming in, Ira?
Well, you know, it's self-published, so it's not getting reviewed because there's, you know, it's not in bookstores.
Right.
So, I mean, the feedback I've gotten from people who've read it has been very favorable.
Good.
I haven't heard anything bad about it. I can't point to, like, oh, the New York Times gave it 3 stars or anything like that,
right,
which is unfortunate.
Well, that may happen.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, it's a tough business. I mean, I tried very hard to convince a publisher to publish it. I had the strangest experience where someone I know in England, who's a very astute music book publisher and agent, said that he didn't think anyone in England would really remember Mark Bolan. And I'm like, well, okay, that's not really the problem. I mean, you know, it's just the title. He goes, well, you have to change the title. And I'm like, okay, that doesn't really make any sense to me. And like, you really think that no one in England would know the name of Mark Bolan? 2020, but anyway, so yeah, I mean, it's tough. I mean, you know, like, because, but social media is good because it allows, you know, people to hear about it and stuff. And, you know, I mean, you found out about it on social media, so that's
exactly.
A good thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, it's moving along. I guess I've sold, you know, 300-400 copies by now or something like that.
That's
you
great.
Know, some of them are e-books and some of them are paperbacks.
And you can purchase them through Amazon, and also can you get it through the Trouser Press website as well? Or
no, that just takes you to Amazon. Amazon has a service where they print on demand. So you give them like all the artwork and all the pages and everything like that, and when someone orders it, they make one. So there's no warehouse full of them. So yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm still toying with other options. I mean, there's a few ways of going about this, but so far that's been my primary thing because it's the easiest way to do it. I mean, it's a lot of work getting it ready for them, but once you've done it, it just kind of putters along, and they send you money from time to time.
And then, of course, you know, I mean, I'm sure I'm not the only one. You may be one as well, but this could be a great film.
Yeah, it could be a great film. I mean, you know, there's a funny thing I ran into. I have a British agent who I had lunch with last
of
couple of years
you
ago.
Did.
Yeah. He's a sub-agent. He's not my primary agent. And he said, you know, I took this to one of the publishers in town, and they said, well, they weren't interested because they had just published a book, an American book, in England on a very similar subject. And so it turned out this book called, Daisy Six, Daisy, forgetting
oh,
the name.
Oh, I've read
and the Six. Yeah,
yeah
so
yeah,
somebody and the Six. And it's a California author, and it's about a woman who joins this band. It's about this band, basically. It's kind of like a Fleetwood Mac-y kind of band,
mm-hmm.
but they seem a little hipper and younger, and they're American. And she falls in love with a singer, and then she's like this like sort of golden girl, and she gets everything she wants, and then the singer and she don't break up, it's a good book. I mean, but it's done as an oral history. It's a completely fictionalized oral history. So it's like, you know, like Bob says this, and then Jane says that, and then Bill says this. So it's a little bit weird, but it's effective. And that got bought by Drew Barrymore and is being made into like a Netflix series.
I
so
see.
Yeah, I suspect that the rock book movie business may be closed to me, but yeah, I do think it would make a great book, great film.
It would, whether or not it's close to you or not, and I don't think it would be close to you, but it would make a great film. So really,
yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny. One of the things that I was originally inspired by was my sort of negative reaction to Velvet Goldmine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, I thought Velvet Goldmine just wasn't really about the time and music. It was about kind of people and you know, who just happened to be there. You know, I mean, it's sort of a story about, you know, kind of like hero worship and you know, degradation and things like that. And, you know, I mean, it just seemed like a very narrow appraisal of the time and place. There's a much better film called Something of a Fool with Daniel, the guy that plays Bond.
We're blanking out here.
Yeah, right. it's called like Confessions of a Fool or Memories of a Fool, and it's not really about glam rock, but there's a scene in it in which he and this girl dance to a Roxy Music song in like full regalia as teenagers, and it's just awesome. It's exactly what I was trying to do in my book. You know, it's really beautiful. But yeah, I mean, you know, filmmaking, you know, my wife keeps encouraging me to write screenplays, and I just suspect that I don't really understand how films get made, although it drives her crazy when we're watching shows on TV and I know the dialogue that's about to happen just because it's constructed in a way that I would be able to recognize it if I was doing it.
Right.
You know, it's like you get used to the tropes, right? I mean, you know, you've seen enough movies in your life, you know how these things go. But, you know, in my own defense, I will say that I tried really hard in this book to not be predictable. You know, I mean, I'm in this book club online and just read a bestseller, and it doesn't matter which one. And I thought it was really awful. I mean, it was just like dumb, you know, full of coincidences and like impossible things that couldn't have happened. The time frames were all screwed up and stuff like that. And I thought to myself, you know, like, and of course it has a happy ending. And I thought to myself, you know, I really am not cut out to be that kind of a novelist, because I don't believe that stories should wrap up neatly, because they don't work that way. You
That's
know,
not
I mean,
how life is.
You know, yeah, it's not how life is. I mean, people, you know, and not everything that happens in a novel has to be concluded. You know, I mean, right. I tried to leave some loose ends, not like, you know, leaving people hanging, but, you know, but just sort of like, okay, I'm done with this part. I don't really need to go any further. You know, somebody told me the other day that they were really disappointed that there wasn't more, that Lila sort of loses touch with her father as the book goes along. And I'm like, okay, that's an interesting thought, but, you know, but so what? You know, I mean, that's kind of the way it works sometimes. You know, you don't always stay close to your parents.
I had somebody years ago, just to wrap up here, but I had somebody years ago who had just seen, and Titanic, the film, had been out at that point for like mm-hmm. 20 years, but they had just seen it, had never seen it. Mm-hmm. And she came in and to the office and wound up saying, I can't believe they died at the end, you know? You know, I said, well, that's what happened.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it would have been called something other than Titanic.
Right, right.
You know, she's like, well, they could have changed it for the movie. You know, and I'm like, you know, no, things don't tie up that sweetly, you know?
No, I mean, I may have the wrong instinct about this, you know, sort of self-defeating, but I do like to leave things sort of complicated. You know, I mean, you know, they don't have to have a happy ending. And you know, I mean, my book sort of has an ending, but it does not necessarily, I don't know if it's a happy one. I mean, it just sort of, yeah, sort of ends on a bit of a positive note, but it's not. It's certainly like not like everybody goes home, you know, satisfied with what became of them.
Right. So we've been talking to Ira Robbins right here on WUSB Stony Brook on Finn's Revolution, and his new book, Mark Bolan Killed in a Crash, is rich and is surprising, and there are twists and turns, and it's a beautiful portrait. In addition to the plot lines, is that the beautiful portrait of early 70s London, and really, really cool. And Ira, I want to thank you so much for joining us on Finn's Revolution. We'll have you on again to
thank
talk
you so
about
much, Finn. It's been great.
It has been great, and this podcast, of course, will be on tomorrow night, and Ira will send you the link. And
cool.
Until next time, guys, you know, pick up this book, Amazon, Mark Bolan Killed in Crash, Ira Robbins.
And trouserpress.com.
Of course. Ira, thanks so much for joining
us. Thanks, Finn.
All right, man.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.